How well do you understand the implications and the ramifications of God's law, especially the Ten Commandments? Take a deeper look next on Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principled Policy and the Executive Director of Camp American. My usual host has a schedule conflict with me this week, which is why we're not doing another live program. We wanted to continue our series that we've been doing on critical thinking, basically, seeing some of the things that politicians are and aren't doing to show that they aren't really thinking through things. And it's not just politicians, it's pundits, it's people who are writing articles, it's all kinds of different things. In any case, Barry and I were pointing out some of the gaps in the logic and gaps in the critical thinking of some of these individuals and some of the gaps in their ability to think through a situation and possibly thinking to themselves that they were going to be able to do the things they want to do and not get caught at it, as we brought up in the last program. But in any case, Barry and I were not able to record a new program today. So what you're getting is a program that we had originally prepared to air while we were at Camp American. And that was in the third week of June. We were in Camp American doing what we do every summer. And if you don't know what that is, I would suggest you go to our website, www.campamerican.com. That's www.campamerican.com. And there you can pick up actually copies of this lecture, the core of this lecture. You can pick up all kinds of videos on different classes that we've done. Tom DeWeese from the American Policy Center, Larry Pratt from Gun Owners of America, Dr. Michael Kaufman from Environmental Perspectives Incorporated, who talks about global warming. Tom, of course, talks about Agenda 21 and property rights issues. Larry is Gun Owners of America and your right to keep and bear arms and how it applies and the history of it. We've also got things by Pastor David Whitney from the Institute on the Constitution. And in fact, that's what the basis of today's program is. But we also, this last year, had Joel McDermott, an author and a lecturer from American Vision, who has written many, many, many books and done seminars and that kind of thing. But we have... we're going to have, when I finish processing them, videos from his talk on his book that Barry and I use in our Institute on the Constitution class. And his book is called Restoring America, One County at a Time. We think this is a very important book, Barry and I do. That being said, you're going to get a chance, if you'd like, to take one of our Institute on the Constitution classes. If you're anywhere in the Central Ohio area, Barry and I have a class coming up in Sunbury, Ohio. If you don't know where that is, that's north and east of Westerville, which is north and east of Columbus. So Sunbury is right on Route 3. And we will be teaching starting September 8th. In the Sunbury Town Hall, right there in the middle of Sunbury, if you know where that is. You can register for that class at www.campamerican.com. And if you're having trouble finding that, or if you don't want to go to put a new website in there, you can also get there from www.principletopolicy.com. That's this website. But in any case, Barry and I will be teaching a new class. We've already got people signed up for it. There's plenty of room. I think we can take about 30 or 35 students. and we would love to have that many. Again, for details, www.campamerican.com or www.principledpolicy.com. But to get back to it, we also have past lectures from people like Dr. Charles Rice, a former professor at Notre Dame University Law School, who gives talks on critical thinking, especially as it regards the pro-life issue, how basically to deal with the objections that come to you from people who are pro-abortion. And believe me, folks, the idea that somehow pro-choice is not the same as pro-abortion, well, it is. I'm not going to take time to go into that today because I don't have that much time. But the fact is that you're either pro-life or you're not. There is no such thing as pro-choice. Pro-choice is the same as pro-abortion. If you're not against abortion, you're for it. I know people. There are people out there who protested that. Too bad. We also have classes from Mark Harrington from... I'm trying to remember the name of his group now. It used to be Center for Bioethical Reform. Now it's, well, in any case, we'll look that up and we'll get it to you. But you can find out that information by buying one of Mark's videos that we have available. And those are readily available at www.campamerican.com. They're all for sale. And when you... You know, it sounds like a sales pitch. It's not. When you buy one of those videos, the videos themselves have been donated. They are fundraisers for Camp American. You would help us out by buying a video. So we would really appreciate that. That being said, I'm trying to think who else we've had in. We've got videos from all kinds of different people available, all kinds of different lecturers. Camp American is a Christian summer camp where we teach Christian worldview, and we're right now putting together the curriculum for next year. So if you've got a suggestion for something you'd like to see on a worldview camp, we've got, of course, Barry Sheets, who gives lectures on how to do different kinds of things like lobbying, how to approach and communicate with your state representatives, your national representatives, the president, everybody, how to affect policy. Again, if you have something you'd like to see in a worldview class at Camp American, contact us, www.campamerican.com or www.principledpolicy.com. My email is very prominent in both places, and you can get a hold of me there. Now, what are we talking about today in today's class? Well, this is a lecture that comes from one that Pastor David Whitney from Institute on the Constitution gives. That class that he is giving is on the Ten Commandments as the basis of law. And I know that makes a lot of people... shrink back in horror. But Pastor Whitney would tell you the same thing that Barry and I would tell you, is that in response to the people who would say to you that you can't legislate morality, after we got done laughing about that, because we've laughed about that over on this show many times if you've heard us in the past, we would tell you that all legislation is an attempt to legislate morality. There's just no way around that clear fact. All legislation is the legislation of somebody's morality. And why is that important? Well, that's important because we have to ask ourselves a question: whose law is better law? Law that's made arbitrarily by man, who is corrupt in all that he does, or law that comes from the perfect God in heaven? Now, I realize that some people say, well, we don't know what God's law really is. Well, of course we do. We have his law, It's written out. It's in 66 books of the Bible. And you'll note that I said 66. It's not just contained in the Old Testament. It's also reiterated in the New Testament. And I would point to Jesus' words on the Sermon on the Mount, where he, some people, I'm paraphrasing, some people say that I've come to change the law and the prophets, or to abolish the law and the prophets. And he says, I come not to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. And he then goes on to say that not one jot or tittle of the law will pass away until heaven and earth pass away. Well, that's a pretty strong statement that the law is still intact and it's still to be obeyed. But we have to understand that when someone comes to us and says, well, you want to stone people for this or that or another thing. No, I want to apply the equity of the law. Being a Presbyterian, if you know the Westminster Confession of Faith, you will basically see passages in there that basically says that the law has ceased to be except for the general equity thereof. Well, equity is a concept that's a little bit abstract, and I think Pastor Whitney's going to talk about that a little bit, how to apply the law in an equitable fashion. And no, it's not necessarily a etched in stone method that they give in the Old Testament. And remember that some Old Testament law, when Jesus fulfilled that law, it also meant that that law, for instance, the sacrifices, the dietary laws, the laws about trimming your hair and beard and that kind of thing. Gosh, if I was supposed to follow those laws, I'd be in big trouble, because while I have some facial hair, it doesn't look anything like the biblical prescription for facial hair. So that being said, I think this is the third part in a series that Pastor Whitney has done. I will put in at the bottom, when we put it up on the website, I will put in links to previous sections where the first two lectures in this series were presented. And I think you'll find this an interesting kind of very quick exegesis of mostly the second table of the Ten Commandments, but also the last part of the first table. He's going to talk about blue laws at the beginning. I think you'll see that that's an important subject. In any case, we'll get to get on with it. Here is Pastor David Whitney with the last part of the Ten Commandments as the basis of law.
Thank you. It's good to be back with you. How many of you know what a blue law is? Has anybody heard of a blue law? And I just want, for the younger generation here, because I know most of you who are older generation have experienced blue laws. I don't know your name. What's a blue law? What's a blue law? Yeah.
It's kind of like some towns make up these dumb rules that cops can pull you over for. Like in Kentucky, I think you can't put an ice cream cone in your pocket or else you can get a ticket or something.
Okay.
And on intent, it's if a girl has her feet, like if she doesn't have anything on her feet and she's with an older guy, then they can arrest him for something.
Okay. So blue laws are ridiculous laws that shouldn't exist on the books. Anybody else? What's a blue law from the whole audience? What's a blue law?
Blue laws are laws that basically say you can't do business on Sunday.
Amen. And there are the ridiculous laws that are really technically not blue laws, but the blue laws that used to be on the books of every state say that all businesses, unless those are essential services like hospitals and gas stations were determined to be an essential service because you could run out of gas, that only the very essential businesses were to remain open on Sunday. All the rest of the businesses were to be closed. Why was that? Because in those days, America was seeking to follow the law of God, which is the fourth commandment. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. And notice that this commandment would have been a very interesting experience for the Israelites. Remember where the Israelites were receiving this commandment? Where were they receiving it? Mount Sinai. Where had they been 3 months before Mount Sinai? Egypt. What had they been doing in Egypt? slaves. How many days a week did they work? 7 days a week, every day. Hard labor, bitter labor, as slaves worked to death, literally, until they died. And this was an amazing thing that they were now told, you're going to have a day of rest. 1 in 7 will be a day of rest for you. In a sense, this was a tremendous blessing. As a matter of fact, Jesus reemphasized this when he was tussling with the scribes and Pharisees over the issue of the Sabbath. He said, man was not made for the Sabbath, because they were creating all these rules and regulations that made it very difficult to live. Rather, the Sabbath was made for man. It was made for man's good. It was made for man's rest. And indeed, a good civil government is one that encourages a day of rest by its legislative process. And so, for example, the South Carolina Supreme Court said this regarding the Sabbath. The president is allowed 10 days to sign a bill. This is a detail in the Constitution you should become familiar with. He's allowed 10 days to sign a bill with the exception of Sunday. Sunday doesn't factor into those 10 days that he's allowed to sign a bill. The legislature does not sit. Public offices are closed. The government recognizes the day in all things. The observance of the Sunday is one of the usages of the common law recognized by our U.S. and state governments. The Sabbath is still to be supported. And notice what they go on to say, and this is really interesting. They say, the Lord's Day, the day of the resurrection, is to us who are called Christians the day of rest. After finishing a new creation, it is the day of the first visible triumph over death, hell, and the grave. It was the birthday of the believer in Christ, to whom and through whom it opened up the way, which by repentance and faith leads into everlasting life and eternal happiness. On that day we rest. To us, it is the Sabbath of the Lord. It's decent observance in a Christian community is that which ought to be expected. So the rationale for the Sabbath is that this is an essential part of the government encouraging the people who are Christians to obey God's law individually. That is, today, most businesses are open on Sunday. You go to Walmart, you go to Target, you go to grocery stores. All these businesses are open on Sunday, which means all those people in those businesses have to work on Sunday. Actually, the businesses gives them incentives, often time and a half or whatever, to work on Sunday. And so many people are working on Sunday that do not have a day of rest as a result of the government backing away and saying, no, we're not going to have any of these laws that close all businesses except those that are absolutely essential on Sunday. In that same time period, this is 1864, that the Carolina Supreme Court said that, the United States Congress said something very similar. How comes it that Sunday, the Christian Sabbath, is recognized and respected by all the departments of government? In the law, Sunday is a dies non. It cannot be used for the service of legal process, the returns of writs or other judicial purposes. The executive departments, the public establishments, are all closed on Sunday, and on that day, neither House of Congress sits. Here is a recognition by law and by universal usage, not only of the Sabbath, but of the Christian Sabbath, in exclusion of the Jewish or Mohammedan Sabbath. When's the Jewish Sabbath? Saturday. When's the Mohammedan Sabbath? Friday. And actually, now that Mohammedans are becoming more populous, many of them are demanding their time off on Friday to go to prayers at the mosque in communities where Mohammedans are increasingly populated. They say, no, not the Mohammedan, not the Jewish, it's the Christian Sabbath. Why then do the petitioners, and this is a case that was coming to their consideration, why do the petitioners exclaim against this invasion of their religious rights? They're saying, you're invading our religious rights by following the fourth commandment as the government. Why do they not assert that a national Sabbath, no less than a national church, is an establishment of religion? And here's a very good question. We know the First Amendment says, Congress shall not establish any religion as the national religion of our country. But that does not mean that Christianity, in its essence, is to be separated from our government. No, not at all, because the Sabbath is part of our Constitution, and it's demanded by our Constitution. So they're saying, look, the First Amendment has no part of this. You can have Sabbath laws on a national scale and still be following the First Amendment, because the First Amendment essentially only says you can't establish a national church, a national denomination. Christianity is the national religion, even if a particular denomination is not the national denomination. goes, the recognition of the Christian Sabbath is complete and perfect. The officers who receive salaries or per diem compensation are discharged from duty on this day because it is the Christian Sabbath, and yet suffer no loss or diminution of pay on that account. Those who get a per diem, that is, if they're traveling on business for the government, they receive a per diem on each day except the Sabbath day, because they're not doing any government business on the Sabbath day. It is the day of rest. And so, indeed, our founders understood that Sabbath laws and following the Sabbath is an important duty of our civil government. When I was in Montgomery, Alabama, during the protest to remove the Ten Commandments, that ultimately those Ten Commandments were removed, I like what this one individual had there as a sign, quoting Proverbs 28, verse 4. Those who forsake the law praise the wicked. Those who forsake God's law praise the wicked instead of punishing the wicked. And that is indeed what we see taking place in our day. Now, as we move from the fourth commandment to the fifth commandment, there's a bit of debate among Christians as to where to divide the two tables of the law. You recognize that there's one half of the law are the duties that we owe to God, the first table of the law. The second table of the law is the duties that we owe to our fellow man. And the division, the question of the division is, does the fifth commandment, what's the fifth commandment? Honor your father and mother. Does the fifth commandment belong to the first table of the law? First table of the law is the duties we owe to God, our creator. Or does it belong to the second table of the law, the duties that we owe to our fellow man? Now you might say, well, it would make sense, our mother and father are our fellow man, so to speak, so shouldn't it make sense that the fifth commandment is on the second table of the law? Well, look at the text of the fifth commandment. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. God is the focus of this command. And because of what God is commanding us to do with and to our parents, it is therefore, I believe, appropriate that this is part of the first table of the law instead of the second table of the law. And so when we look at the summary, I would divide the commandments into these two categories. The first table, including the fifth commandment, which actually elevates that fifth commandment, that this is not just honoring our parents. This is honoring God when we honor our parents. Now we know, as the commandment is very clear, that the fifth commandment belongs to the first table there. And Ephesians 6 and verse 13, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you, that you may live long on the earth. It's interesting, in the day that Jesus ministered here on earth, there was a debate among the Pharisees and scribes how to obey this command. They understood that you were to honor your father and mother, and that meant that you were to take care of your mother and father in their old age. And so there was no social security, which is not social, it's insecurity. There was a system by which when you reached an age when you could no longer work, who took care of you? Your kids, which is why it was very important in that day to have children. A woman was considered cursed if she had no children, because who was going to take care of her in her old age and her husband in their old age? And so the system by which parents were cared for in their senior years was not something that civil government provided. It was something that family government took care of. You had a lot of kids. You were blessed because, hey, you had all these kids that were going to take care of you in your old age. And in Jesus' day, there was a system by which they said, an individual could give all of their worldly goods to the temple. They could say, I'm going to give everything I have to God. But there was a nice little clause in this contract that said, I got to use all of those worldly goods while I lived. It was only when I died that they actually got transferred and the temple took possession of my property and my bank and all the wealth I had. The catch in this, they said, was if you gave all your things that you owned to God, then you could not use any of those things to minister to your parents in their old age. It was a nice trick out of which children could get away from caring for their parents in the time when their parents were in need. And Jesus rebuked this. He said, this is Mark chapter 7. If you have your Bibles, turn to Mark chapter 7 and verse 9. Mark 7 and verse 9, Jesus said to them, all too well you reject the commandment of God that you may keep your tradition. For Moses said, honor your father and your mother. This is Mark 7 and verse 10. Honor your father and your mother, and he who curses father or mother, let him be put to death. But you say, if a man says to his father or mother, whatever profit you might have received from me, it is korban, that is, it a gift to God. Then you no longer let him do anything for his father or his mother, making the word of God of no effect through your tradition, which you have handed down, and many such things you do. Jesus said, you found a way to violate God's law of honoring father and mother by not caring for your parents in their old age, and it was through this system korban. It's interesting, in the Jewish literature, the Mishnah and several other books, there's an actual case which was brought before their judges, the Jewish judges, to determine what was right or wrong. An individual had given all of his worldly goods to God, korban. That means he could not care for his parents financially in any way, shape, or form, and look at the extent to which he could not care for his parents. In the case, the son was desirous that his father should share in the festivities at his marriage and proposed to give to a friend the court in which the banquet was to be held, the banquet itself, all the food and all the accoutrements of the banquet, but only for the purpose that his father might eat and drink with him. He wanted his father to attend his wedding ceremony and attend the banquet that followed his wedding ceremony. But he had already committed all these worldly goods to the church or to the temple. And the proposal was refused by the Jewish officials. They said it involved sin. And they pointed afterwards and discussed and confirmed this, implying that in no circumstances could a parent partake of anything belonging to his son if he had pronounced such a vow, the only relaxation being in the case of actual starvation. If his parents were starving to death and they didn't have enough to eat, the son might make a present to a third person when the father might in return receive it from the third person. So Jesus was talking about a very clear violation of God's commandment, honor your father and your mother in his day. You're being raised in a culture that has the exact same attitude of the Pharisees that Jesus condemned in that day. You're being raised to believe that you don't have to do anything to help your parents in their old age. Whose job is that? That's either their job to save enough money, pay money into Social Security, retirement funds, whatever it is, and that you are free from any obligation when your parents reach retirement age of caring for them at all. You know what Jesus said? That's a direct violation of the fifth commandment. The fifth commandment says, honor your father and your mother with no limitations upon it. It's not like, well, when you reach age 18 and you leave your home, that's it. You don't have to honor them anymore. No, it says you honor them throughout your entire life. Yes, it changes from when you're a five-year-old and you're commanded to do this, that, and the other, and you're a 30-year-old and your parents are no longer commanding your life specifically, but you are still to honor them. And honor them in the highest regard. And as we mentioned earlier, this is the only commandment with a positive implication. Positive commands mean, in a sense, there's no limit upon them. They're a command that gives you a wide-ranging thing that you are to do. It's not a very limited thing, such as the negative commandments. And that means honoring your father and mother is something that you and I need to work hard at in everything that we say about them, in our attitudes towards them, in our actions towards them, that we will honor them in every area of life. Well, you know, the enemies of God's plan, they have a substitute plan that they've actually been trying to work in our culture and other cultures around the world. It's the Marxist plan for the family. Do you know that Engels and Marx, they wrote up what they viewed for the family? Frederick Engels, in his book, The Origin of the Family and Private Property in the State, states very clearly that the abolition of the family goes hand in hand with the abolition of private property and the establishment of the Marxist state. You see, they understood, the evil ones understand, that the family, if it's strong, stands in their way of achieving absolute tyranny and dictatorship over the people. They know that the family loyalties have to be broken and destroyed, and that's what they are aiming to do. He even talks about, replacing the old collectivity, the family, that's what they call the old collectivity, with the new collectivity, the state. That essentially what their design would be that there are no families at all. In fact, that the family is being usurped in every area of its responsibility. Whose responsibility is it to educate children? Parents. It's never the state's responsibility, yet most Christians today believe it's the state's job to educate my children, don't they? Most Christians believe that. You take other areas of God's responsibility for family, property ownership belongs to all these things that belong to the family are being usurped by the state that is following this Marxist plan. In fact, if you were to reduce it to the final end, the only thing left for the family to do is to reproduce children. And the state wants to control that as well. A perfect example is what takes place in China. And do you know that our American government takes taxpayers' dollars to enforce the policy of one child per family in China? It's enforced by the state, which means every woman in China is monitored for her cycle to determine when she becomes pregnant. If she's already had a child and she becomes pregnant, the state forces her to have an abortion. And our taxpayer dollars pay for that to happen in China today. That's the Marxist plan, that ultimately the only job that the family has, and actually they're going to destroy the family altogether, the only job that human beings have is to reproduce children. Children that are reproduced according to their plan on their timetable, that only the children they permit to come into existence, that are born, come into the world. And so we see their plan is the exact opposite of God's plan. It's a wicked and a destructive plan for all of us. The fifth commandment is the only positive commandment. The positive law in all the other realms is a very grave danger to our religious and civil liberties. God placed the family as the most notable, most noble, and the most significant institution on earth. It was the only institution created in the Garden of Eden, and it is more important than the church, and it is more important than the civil government. And that's why the civil government, the wicked civil government, seeks to destroy the family in our day. Well, we have very little time, so let me run quickly. I apologize. This course normally takes 12 hours, so we're reducing it quite a bit to fit it in here. So, but if you're interested in getting the 12-hour version, you can go to our website, and I'll direct you as to the CD that deals with that. The sixth commandment. What's the sixth commandment deal with? Now, murder, that's right. Thou shalt not murder. And Jesus answered the question, which is the greatest commandment? Thou shalt love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law of the prophets. And so each of these in the second table of the law, Jesus identifies first table of the law, it's focused on God, the duties we owe to our Creator. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. The second table of the law deals with the duties that we owe to our neighbor. How do you love your neighbor? Well, the first way you love your neighbor is you don't murder him, right? That's pretty plain. If you murder your neighbor, it's obvious you don't love your neighbor. So it's obviously, first of all, a prohibition on murder, but it also prohibits, if I can bring this up here, also prohibits any unjust violence towards another person. There is just violence that's by law, in obedience to God's law, but any unjust violence is also countenanced by this command. John Calvin wrote, the sum of this command is that we should not unjustly do violence to anyone. And this is a command that was given at the very beginning. God gave it in Genesis 9, verse 6, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God, he made man. Let me ask you, looking at Genesis chapter 9 and verse 6, what does that say about the death penalty? Is the death penalty a just or an unjust law? It's just. It's perfectly just. Why is it just? Notice what the rationale is for putting someone to death who took the life of another human being. The reason you do that is God made every human being in the image of man. Therefore, if you murder another person, you have slapped God in the face. You have marred the image of God. You have done the most offensive thing you can to the image of God here on earth, which is only man. And Romans 13 speaks to this. For he, that is the civil magistrate, is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. The sword, you know, we don't carry swords today and so forth, so we don't think of swords in that vein, but swords are used for what in that day? Kill, to execute. They use the sword to execute individuals. And the civil magistrate bears the sword because it's his responsibility to put to death those who break God's law, specifically the sixth commandment. He's an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. Now, the full implications of the sixth commandment are these. There is such a thing as just war. We were having a debate about this and talk about this last night. There is such a thing as just war. In other words, there are times and places, a very limited and restricted place, but civil government can defend the people within its jurisdiction from an attack by an outside invader. In fact, taking the life of those soldiers who are invading their territory. So just war is countenanced here. Self-defense. That is, you have a God-given right to prevent another person from taking your life. Do you know that? The Sixth Commandment countenances this. If somebody attacks you seeking to take your life, you can defend yourself even to the point of putting them to death if their aggression against you is to such an extent that they would take your life. You have a God-given duty to protect your life.
Yes.
I was talking with Tim last night about in the Last Supper, where Jesus says, if you don't have a sword, go buy one.
Very good.
I saw how you wrote on that. And yet, then right after that, in the garden, he tells Peter not to use the sword.
That's right. And that might seem to be a contradiction, right? Why did Jesus say, Peter, don't use the sword now? He cut the ear off, and Jesus took the ear, picked it up off the ground, stuck it back on, and healed him.
It wasn't time for it.
That's right. What was it time for to happen right then and there? And Jesus to go to the cross. So Jesus, there, in other words, we could lay down our lives. There could be times that we are called to be a martyr, and that we go to the death in defense of the gospel of Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior. There could be times where we do that. But in general, unless it's very specific that God's called us to that, which Jesus very clearly knew, he was going to the cross. God had ordained him to go to the cross. God had told him to drink that cup. And so he was saying, Peter, don't prevent me from going to the cross. This is what the Father's will is. Outside of that, however, you're right. It would have been righteous to defend him and say, no, this arrest is unjust. What's taking place here is a kangaroo court. This whole process is unjust. It should not be allowed to take place. So we should, as you gain your age of majority, you should obtain a weapon, just as Jesus told the disciples. If you don't have a sword, go sell your coat and buy a sword, because you need to prepare yourself to defend yourself and to defend others who might be put in harm's way as well. Excellent question.
Yes.
Sir, is it an assumption, or is it you have a verse where we can go to that says that we can use lethal force to protect ourselves?
When we are, there's this example where Jesus told them to go buy a sword if you don't own a sword. I don't have it off the top of my head, but I will get it for you. It's in the upper room, and we'll find it in a minute here for you. But and it's very specific. I spoke on this in a debate I had on PBS with the gun grabbers were trying to get as many churches across America to have gun-free, basically, days and encourage all the people to give up their weapons and so forth. And so PBS asked me to debate that issue, and I entered into a debate with them 2 summers ago, I think it was. And the sword that Jesus told them to go purchase was a short sword that was used for self-defense.
It's Luke 22:36.
Luke 22:36. Thank you. And the sword he told them was one that was specifically used for self-defense. So Jesus was not saying go out and get a battle sword and prepare for war. He was saying get a sword. And again, I can give you the research on this in terms of the type of sword he instructed them to get. It was a self-defense sword. So in our day, we don't use swords to defend ourselves. What do we use? Guns. A handgun. A rifle. So self-defense is countenanced in this respect. When we understand that the Sixth Commandment, not only am I to prevent somebody, not only am I to prevent myself from taking another person's life, I am to be engaged in society to prevent other people from taking the lives of other individuals, including preventing someone from taking my life. I have a God-given duty, unless otherwise instructed by our Lord, to prevent anyone from taking my life, even to the point of taking theirs. And again, we'd have to point out the scriptures that talk about in the Old Testament where people are being attacked, where they defend themselves with force, even to the point of taking the life of the other individual.
Why then would Jesus cut off his sword when he cut off the head of the high priest?
Because Jesus was going to the cross, and he knew
Peter did it in self-defense for himself.
No, he didn't. He did it to defend Jesus. Peter was not under arrest. Jesus was under arrest.
Which, who are you going to say you're assuming who he was trying to defend, but it could very logically be a move to self-defense.
It was defense for Jesus because Peter was not being arrested. Jesus was being arrested. Well, they fled after he cut the... Right. But it was actually Jesus he was trying to defend because Jesus was the one being arrested. It was not Peter being arrested.
Well, they were just there to arrest him. They weren't there to kill him.
Right.
So he was going to go through the regular
kill him right there, so there was no premeditation.
True, you could say that, but in a sense, Peter was trying to do an action that would release Jesus from the arrest. And Jesus said, no, I'm going to the cross. This is the path that God has ordained for me. Again, we could really spend a whole lot of time on the sixth commandment, because there is a whole lot of implications here that we need to understand that Jesus is talking about. But let me move quickly on here. Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, it goes beyond just physical action, the sixth commandment. Yes, one more question.
You mentioned that when you become a baby, you don't have a weapon, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you reconcile that with the following verse after Luke 22:36, where the disciples show him that they have two swords among the 12 of them, and he says that is enough?
Mm-hmm. Would Peter or any of the other disciples, in other words, Jesus was saying that is enough for now, I believe. When he sent out the disciples, how did he send them out? Two by two. And part of that was for protection. That it's much easier to overcome one individual when they're out on their own than it is to overcome two. When Paul traveled in his missionary journeys, he always traveled with at least two of them. And they were attacked many places they went. And they chose not to defend themselves physically, although they could have chosen to defend themselves physically. And they made that decision based upon, as Paul said on several occasions, he made his decision based upon the furtherance of the gospel would be helped if they allowed the arrest, they allowed the imprisonment, they allowed some things to happen that were unjust that he could have defended himself against.
But isn't the early church espoused the view of nonviolence for several hundred years after the death of Jesus? It's more, it was after that that we started.
Are you talking about nonviolence in terms of the civil government? In other words, war and
as a matter of their creed.
As a matter of them individually doing nothing to protect themselves if attacked. Let's go back and look at what Jesus said that is usually taken as the scripture that governs that. Jesus said, if they slap you on one cheek, turn the other, right? And people say, okay, we should always turn the cheek. When someone slaps you on the cheek, have they engaged in a life-threatening action? No. They have insulted you, they have hurt you, they have assaulted you. Assault and battery could be charged against them. But they have not taken a sword out and driven it through your heart. If they take a sword out, Jesus, and this commandment says that we have an obligation by God to protect our life whenever we can. That we are seeking to protect our life. And I would contend, the scripture would point, to the point at which another person attacking us, we can protect our life even to the point of taking their lives. And the difficulty is to do this at a small enough frame of time because we have to bring in a number of other scriptures from the Old and New Testament to deal with it. But you're right, the New Testament church and the era following the New Testament church was largely pacifist in terms of their actions and attitudes towards even self-defense. I'm not persuaded that that's biblical, you know. And we could further discuss that, but those are excellent questions. Beyond just the physical actions, Jesus talks about what's going on in your heart. I say to you, who's ever angry with his brother without cause shall be in danger of the judgment. Calvin said this commandment also prescribes that everyone should study faithfully to defend the life of his neighbor and practically to declare that it is dear to him that our neighbors are so loved that their life is as dear to them as ours. Further implications. Look at the Declaration's first God-given right. Think of the Declaration of Independence. You have the right to, what's the first right? Life. Why? Where does that come from? It comes directly from the Sixth Commandment. You see, the Sixth Commandment in its exposition, the Declaration of Independence is saying you have a God-given right, and the first God-given right you have that the government is supposed to protect is your right to life. Furthermore, you go to the Fifth Amendment in the Bill of Rights. It commands that no one is to be deprived of life without due process of law, without a process by which it's determined that the taking of this human being's life is a just taking of life. Thomas Jefferson wrote, "Our liberties are the gift of God. They're not to be violated but with his wrath. Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep." And this would mean the death penalty was clearly envisioned in the scriptures and throughout the scriptures. I know that there's those who would say that the New Testament does not countenance civil government taking the lives of wicked individuals. I would contend to you that Romans 13, that I just quoted, very clearly says the sword is to be used to execute those who are worthy of death. and that therefore it is a false argument that the New Testament would never countenance civil government imposing the death penalty. I know people who do that generally say, the Old Testament says this, the New Testament says this, let's ignore what the Old Testament says, but that, I believe, is not a biblical position to take. Now, this command also involves very clear limitations upon the civil government, and those limitations mean it is limited to dealing with the actions of human beings alone. The precepts and philosophy of the Hebrew code, this is Thomas Jefferson, laid only hold of actions. Jesus pushed his scrutinies into the heart of man, erected his tribunal in the regions of his thoughts, and purified the waters at the fountainhead. And so God never gave civil government any jurisdiction in the realm of heart and thought attitudes. That's the realm of family government. That is certainly the realm of church government, but it is never the realm of civil government. The commandments for civil government are to punish actions, not thoughts, which is why every idea of a hate crime legislation is illegitimate. They're talking about hate crimes legislations in Washington, D.C. today, and it is completely illegitimate for them to do so. Well, let's quickly move on to the seventh commandment. This encompasses not just adultery in the small sense of that word, but rather all the sexual immorality countenanced in Leviticus chapter 18, which includes sodomy and bestiality and so on, polygamy. Every form of immorality is condemned by God. And the seventh commandment includes a condemnation of all of those cases of immorality. It's interesting, the Supreme Court said this regarding marriage in 1885 case. Certainly, no legislation can be supposed more wholesome and necessary in the founding of a free, self-governing commonwealth than that which seeks to establish it on the basis of the idea of the family, as considering it in springing from the union for life of one man and one woman in the holy estate of matrimony. Marriage is the sure foundation of all that's stable and noble in our civilization, the best guarantee of that reverent morality, which is the source of all beneficial progress and social political improvement. The society depends upon this institution, marriage, and it is the job of civil government to do everything it can to protect that institution, which includes laws that would make it very difficult to get divorced. It used to be in the United States that to get a divorce, you had to prove in a court of law that there was fault. That is, that someone in the marriage had violated God's law. And the evidence was presented there in court such that the courts could say, yes, there is fault in this case. And the fault is that this person in the marriage, and the result is, therefore, a divorce can be granted. Well, there was a man who's honored by many Christians who became president, before he became president, he was governor of the state of California, and he was the first governor to sign a no-fault divorce law. That was Ronald Reagan. No-fault divorce law suddenly meant two people went into court and nothing had to be proved that anything was done wrong in that marriage whatsoever. One person could say, I just want out of this marriage, for whatever reason or for no reason at all. I want out of this marriage. And the state would grant them a divorce. From California, it spread to all 50 states, and today divorce is commonplace in America because the civil government failed to do its God-ordained duty to protect the holy institution of marriage, that is, to preserve the seventh commandment. And a case that is interesting, particularly in our day, is not only sodomy is being considered marriage, but the next question is bigamy. You know, three men and one woman, or whatever combination you want to think about that the Mormons long ago were involved in doing. Well, that was ruled as against God's law very early in our country. Here's a Supreme Court case, Davis v. Beeson in 1890. Bigamy and polygamy are crimes. Get that? They're crimes. And by the laws of all civilized and Christian countries. They are crimes by the laws of the United States, and they are crimes by the laws of Idaho. This was a case in Idaho with Mormons. And they tend to destroy the purity of the marriage relation, to disturb the peace of families, to degrade women, and to debase man. To extend exemption from punishment for such crimes would be to shock the moral judgment of the community, to call their advocacy a tenet of religion, which is essentially what the Mormons of that day were saying. Bigamy is part of our religion. We have religious freedom, therefore we can practice bigamy. They said no. To call their advocacy a tenet of religion is to offend the common sense of mankind. There have been sects which denied as part of their religious tenets that were that there should be any marriage tie at all, and advocating promiscuous intercourse of the sexes as prompted by the passions of its members. Should such a sect, either of these kinds, ever find its way into this country, swift punishment would follow the carrying into effect of its doctrines, and no heed would be given to the pretense that their supporters could be protected in their exercise by the Constitution of the United States, specifically referring to the First Amendment, protection of religious freedom. No way. They said that bigamy, polygamy, obviously sodomy, these are all destructive of this essential institution. We must protect marriage and the family, and the only way is to abide by God's law in abiding by the seventh commandment. As I mentioned before, we'll just quickly go through this. The attack on the seventh with no-fault divorce. Marriage, the foundation of all civilization, is now considered optional. In my state, they've gone to a ruling that's called partnerships. Anybody over the age of 18 in the state of Maryland can say, this person over here, male or female, is my partner. And they enjoy some of the privileges legally of marriage by having this partner. And they can dissolve this partnership with a piece of paper, just write a piece of paper, hand it in the civil matter, it's dissolved, it's gone. Which means anyone who's not a Christian following God's law is not going to bother to get married. Why get married and have all the encumbrances when you can enjoy the benefits without the commitment or the price? Trust is essential in any society. Promises, vows, pledges, loyalties all vanish if they're broken with impunity. Society turns on keeping pledges and punishing violations of those pledges. And so credit, for example, is an extension of the principle into the business world. The contract is established by spoken word. It's no better than the word that was spoken by the individuals. What an adulterer really does is to break a particularly solemn vow. By his act, he tramples upon marriage itself, mocks God, and to society. And basically what we have today is adultery is no longer punished in our land, and the result is the destruction of marriage is moving rapidly. The eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal, that is, taking another man's property, is forbidden by coercion, whether you persuade him to give it up by some lie that you, or by fraud, or taking the property without his consent, cheating him out of the property, harming his property. That is, if you do damage to somebody's car, you walk by somebody's car with a key, you have stolen, you have violated the eighth commandment. You've purposely damaged another person's property. Is owning property an inalienable right given to us by God? Is it? Yes, it is. And it's the job of the civil government to protect that rather than what it's doing today in destroying that. I encourage you to get the little book, called The Law, that speaks about this idea of legalized plunder. A very interesting concept that when governments conspire together to steal from the people, which is what we have in our day, and Bastiat ably describes it, it is nothing other than a violation of the eighth commandment. It is legalized plunder. All men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with the right to life, liberty, and property. Notice how each of these is connected to the Ten Commandments. Your right to life, secured by the sixth commandment. Your right to liberty is actually secured in the first commandment. That is, if you worship the one true God, and Him alone do you serve, you will have liberty. If you worship any other god, you will experience tyranny. And the pursuit of happiness, which is actually the larger category of all of your economic freedom, the freedom to own property, the freedom to keep the fruits of your labor, all are encompassed in the pursuit of happiness. That's secured by the eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal. Well, let me quickly move on here. The ninth commandment, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Now, the context in which this is speaking is a courtroom. You're brought in as a witness. You swear that you're going to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth, so help you God. And if that is not practiced, that is, if you particularly lie, you are going to violate the right of your neighbor. Your neighbor is going to lose his life, his property, his liberty, or something of that nature because of the lie that you tell. Telling lies, especially in court, does great damage to your neighbors. We'll just run on quickly here to the 10th commandment because we're just about out of time. Not coveting. Now, this one has to do with your attitudes. Coveting is to have an unlawful desire to possess something that it is your neighbor's. And in this respect, whenever the government involves itself in creating a society based on covetousness, much of what takes place in election seasons, is basic covetousness. Do you envy those rich people over there? Why don't you vote for me? Because I'm going to steal their goods and I'm going to give it to you. That's what the pandering politicians of our day usually promise in elections. And these covetous desires usually go beyond just simply coveting. They go to actions that ultimately involve you stealing the property of your neighbor. We won't look at Alexander Tyler, his quotes there in your notes. Basically, a society that allows people to vote themselves largesse from the public treasury is a society on its way to destruction. And we have that with our licensed counterfeiters. I don't have a bill on me here, but if you've got one of those green pieces of paper we use to exchange for goods and services, do you know that it's actually counterfeit money? It is counterfeit money because if you read the Constitution, the only lawful money in America is gold or silver. And those pieces of paper are not backed by gold or silver. They're just printed pieces of paper backed by absolutely nothing. What we have in the Federal Reserve is licensed counterfeiters, been licensed by Congress, and they're destroying and stealing the wealth of the American people. I refer to this series, if you're interested in much more detail, the 12-hour version, the Ten Commandments and American Law, that you could find on our website at iotconline.com. Let me close by just telling you of what Francis Grund wrote in his book, Aristocracy in America. The American Constitution is remarkable for its simplicity, but it can only suffice a people habitually correct in their actions and would be utterly inadequate to the wants of a different nation. So what do we need to have happen here in America to restore liberty? We need to have a revival, where people return individually to obedience to God's law, where families return to obedience to God's law, an amazing thing, where churches start obeying God's law as well. Change the domestic habits of the Americans, their religious devotion, and their high respect for morality, and it will not be necessary to change a single letter in the Constitution in order to vary the whole form of their government. We've had a revolution in America, and the revolution has swept away an obedience to God's law, which is the foundation of all that is sound. As I was there in Alabama and witnessed that beautiful monument in the Supreme Court of the state of Alabama, I was also there to witness the evil that was done, where they took the Ten Commandments from the rotunda of the Alabama Supreme Court and they put them in a closet. They put God's law in a closet. And what has come out in our culture, not just from that time but much earlier, what has come out of the closet is the horrible abominations that we see in our land today. You know, God gave the Ten Commandments in stone, but Satan has his Ten Commandments. They're in Elberton, Georgia. They're called Stonehenge of America. And the very first principle of Satan's Ten Commandments is this: the sustainable human population of planet Earth is 500 million people. The Satanists and the one-worlders and the ones who are seeking to steal our liberty have stated their principle. There's too many people on planet Earth. In fact, there's 6 billion too many people. And their aim is to get rid of everybody that stands in our way, including in their way, including all Christians. And if Christians don't stand for God's law and for the Ten Commandments, Satan's law, we can expect to be what replaces it. Thank you very much for your attention. I don't think we have time for any questions.
Well, I hope you found that as informative as I did. Actually, that I found that very the whole three lectures very informative, and that was the last part of it. We're kind of out of time for today, but I wanted to remind you that we do have this class opening up in Sunbury. We're also working on a class that may be taught. We're negotiating currently for a class to be taught in Circleville. And we'll let you know the details of that as they become available. But in any case, our Sunbury class starts September 8th. It's in the Sunbury City Center, right there in the center of town, if you're familiar at all with Sunbury. There is a nominal fee that covers the workbook and the extra books. Some people think it's a little steep. It's not. It comes out to about $6 a week for 12 weeks. And as you know, that's really not very much money. Barry and I do not take a salary out of this. Any money over and above the cost of the books goes to Camp American as a donation. And you will get credit for that since Camp American is a 501c3. But in any case, please check us out at www.campamerican.com or www.principledpolicy.com. And join us with that for that class in Sunbury beginning September 8th in the city center there in Sunbury, Ohio. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.